Station number 11883, Mr. C. E. Anson, Reel 5.
Branson, Reel 5.
He introduced himself as the Prince of Wales, and when we were a bit taken aback, he explained that his name was Prince, and he was a confectioner from Wales in Upper Austria. And he was a charming fellow who cooked for us very well with our reduced rations and stayed with us for a little while. But the one I have in particularly affectionate memory was a plumber from Saxony who spoke with a broad Saxon accent, a small, dry man who had been imprisoned and then sent to the Strafbataillon because he was caught giving a French prisoner of war a crust of bread, which apparently was a very heinous offense. And he was very much an anti-Nazi. And having served in the pioneer section of that unit, came over to us to help us with the mines that had been laid round Sarande. And very effectively he did it. And helped us to lay the white tapes through the minefields and to prepare our attack. And just before the attack went in, he and I were sitting on the obverse of the hillside with the Royal Support Regiment's four-inch mortars, 3.5-inch mortars, putting the preparation onto Sarande. And he was telling me about his background and about his job. He was very proud of his profession. And he said, you know, I can still hear his voice, what I like best is to equip a barracks and there are no divisions between the toilets. And when you see all these brand new toilet bowls, glistening new, dressed by the right like the soldiers, ah, it gladdens your heart. Das freut das Herz. He was a charming fellow and also helped a good deal afterwards with the booby traps in Sarande proper, until I'm afraid he caught one himself and he got a bit of a fragment into his leg, not far from his knee, what was brought into the bank, which served as a dressing station. And the Marines, who had grown very fond of him, started to come in and give him chocolate minges and barrettes or whatever. And the tears were rolling down his, he was so deeply touched down his cheeks, and he said, ah, you are such good people. Make sure you go after those devils and you catch them. And eventually, with a little testimonial signed by us, he was shipped off to the prisoner of war camp in Italy, and I hope that he was treated appropriately. Now, so far as Corfu is concerned, we stayed there. It must have been until the end of October or middle of November of 1944. But although by then civil war had broken out, I believe, in Greece, and the tensions were certainly very unpleasant, we were never fortunately directly involved in that rather unhappy chapter of Allied Greek relations. There were various different types of Greek partisan units, including EAM, ELAS, Kappa Kappa Epsilon, and a company of Evzones. But although it was a rather explosive mixture in those heady days, it never actually came to an explosion, and perhaps we managed to help a little bit by ostentatiously being friendly to everybody concerned in walking about without weapons. Certainly the population was extremely welcoming, and they were very, very Anglophile. Most of them spoke beautiful English. It had been a naval, a port of call, a regular port of call of the Mediterranean fleet. They even had a cricket club, which I hadn't come across in a non-English-speaking country before. And we had a wonderful welcome. The warmth of welcome there was in sharp contrast to the harsh conditions we had experienced before in Albania. We returned from Corfu to the mainland about November, I would say, of 1944. I believe we saw Christmas actually at Monopoly, and also a small detachment of people from our troop came out just about that time, or it may have been just after Christmas, New Year. I seem to remember welcoming my good friend Karl Walter Billmann, who was by now Kenneth Bartlett, Kenneth Walter Bartlett, and who had done very well in Normandy and been commissioned in the field, with two other of my former colleagues who had also become officers in Normandy, being David Stewart and the name escapes me, it may surface later. He was sent out in order to raise a half troop under his command, with me as his troop sergeant, in order to take part in further operations in Italy, which was duly done. There were some, like myself, who were already in the central Mediterranean from our troop, and others were recruited, including some Palestinian volunteers who were in Italy. There were some people from North Africa. There were some people who had been in the French Foreign Legion and volunteered, if they were German speakers, were directed our way, and we recruited this half troop and trained it to the best of our ability, following the excellent training schemes laid down for ourselves when we were trained in the first place. Much of this took place in a small village called Minervino Le Murge, which is in the plain of Andria in southern Italy, and the troop was reasonably well licked into shape. We must, of course, remember that anybody who joined a commando had already been a soldier for some considerable time and probably seen action in other capacities anyway. And with this half troop, we eventually went north to be stationed at Ravenna in order to take part in the final actions, as it turned out, of the war, which included the actions in the Valle di Comacchio and the Argenta Gap. And that is where we saw the end of the war. We had been standing by in case we were wanted for any amphibious operations in the Po Delta, but it didn't come to that. The German armies collapsed. In fact, they collapsed largely on us, and we suddenly found that we had to put wire around enormous fields in which row after row after row of dejected German soldiers would settle down and wait to be fed and watered. And the war was over. The European war was over. We saw the end of that in Ravenna. And in the sergeant's mess, I was one of a group listening to Mr. Churchill telling us of the final surrenders having been signed in Northwest Europe. And everybody expected to be greatly elated and to have a huge celebration. But I'm afraid the actual effect on us at the time was one of complete anticlimax. Some people drank more than usual, other people just went for a long walk, and one felt as though the company you'd been working for the last 6 years had suddenly gone bankrupt. It was a very odd reaction, quite unexpected. Our half troop went back down south to Naples in a slow goods train, which in summer is a delightful way of traveling in Italy, sitting in armchairs we had organized ourselves in the big open goods wagon doors, and letting the Italian landscape slowly drift by while brewing up tea. And from Naples went back to England, where we were stationed at Seaford, serving out the remaining days of the existence of our unit by pretending to carry on with military duties, such as compass marches, where, oddly enough, when you got to the intersection of each bearing, it might be at a point on the map where it said in, and punctuated by the occasional cream tea, we tended to come back to our billets at Seaford in a very happy state. And it is there that we saw the end of the commandos, which the army commandos, which were of course disbanded soon after hostilities ceased, after the hostilities in the Far East. I was in England, indeed on leave in London, for VJ Day to see the actual end of the war in the Far East as well. Any fears that we might be sent to the Far East then evaporated. The unit was dissolved, and we were, since we were still in the army, attached here and there to formations or organizations which might be useful. Now, the rest, I think, is indicated on that questionnaire. I was attached to the Control Commission for Germany and sent to Frankfurt at my request, in my hope to find my mother, who I had left there, and indeed did find her, and was actually stationed just outside Höchst in a little British enclave called in the village of Sindlingen, working for that field intelligence agency, Technical, Fiat, partly translating fascinating documents, including Speer documents in Berlin, Speer ministry documents of the Ministry of Weapons and Equipment in Berlin, where I was sent from time to time on a most luxurious train originating in Frankfurt, in Paris, via Frankfurt to Berlin, staying there in a flat for perhaps a week, with two secretaries who were absolutely, but to whom I used to translate without stopping for any words I couldn't find, just leaving a gap, and carrying on the afternoon with the one, whereas the other was already transcribing what we'd done in the morning. And we got through a lot of the Speer documentation that way.
When you say Speer, you mean the famous organizer?
That's right, who was the minister in charge of the ministry called Weapons and Equipment, Waffen und Gerät, which was quite an eye-opener.
In what way?
Partly in showing the resilience with which they managed to improvise in spite of the most harsh interdictions of their industries being thoroughly demolished, but on the other also the rigidities which made their organization terribly brittle and very fragile, with different services, different ranks, different political interests, backstabbing and politicking, negating each other's efforts, and leading to ludicrous situations in which one part of the, say, armaments industry would turn out large numbers of the excellent assault rifle 44, for instance, which was badly needed for firepower in the East, while the factories which were intended to make the 9mm ammunition for it were stopped by somebody who had an additional pip on his shoulder and banged fist on table and said, nope, they will make rifle ammunition for the standard issue rifle, and then they'd stand there with a lot of beautiful weapons without the necessary ammunition. I oversimplify, but there were a lot of very brittle inability to adapt and cooperate, and it showed up a contrast with the British flexibility, which may have been in some ways quite amateurish, but which muddled through, where they would, with all their monolithic efficiency and machinery, get stuck because of an inability to react to changing situations very often. And yet, the ingenuity, especially the technical and industrial ingenuity, the ingenuity in the field of weaponry, was quite stunning. And in view of what is going on at this particular moment in the Middle East, I think it also warns us not to be too sure that under the harshest interdiction and severest bombardment and destruction of all kinds of infrastructure and industry, people with the right motivation and ingenuity can sometimes survive for a long time. Much of my time was also spent traveling with extremely interesting people who were at the peaks of their professions or disciplines in England and in Britain, and went to meet the exponents of their particular fields in Germany, with whom there had been no communication over the last 6 years, in order to exchange notes and fill information of the war years. And that was, of course, particularly fascinating for me, and I learned a very great deal. There were high-powered medical people, psychologists, surgeons, there were industrialists, there were technicians, scientists. It was really, really interesting. To see my mother in Frankfurt was psychologically very strange. Of course I felt at home with her, but she had survived the war with great stamina and toughness and cheerfulness, in spite of very harsh conditions. They had to do heavy labor during the war, because obviously she was not in very good odor with the authorities. But she survived the bombing in Frankfurt and lived in very straitened circumstances, obviously. So it was a great delight to find her, and to find her physically and mentally okay. But to walk the streets, destroyed as they were, moon crater landscapes where you concluded from the type of the cobblestones and the tram lines and the branch in the tram lines where there was points, and you realized that you must be at the junction of Oederweg and Eschersheimer Landstraße, where my school used to be. To walk these particular streets with a ghost of a German schoolboy walking ahead, with whom I had absolutely nothing in common anymore, was an almost schizophrenic psychological stress. And to get back to my people, to my sergeant's mess, where I could relax and feel at home, really showed up to me how I'd changed.
What was the mood of the Frankfurters in general after the war and the destruction by bombing and the occupation?
Extremely negative, extremely depressed, and apart from some friends I met, family friends, who always had been anti-Nazis and who were at least relieved that that was over, it was, I don't think despondent is too strong a word. It is remarkable that they should so soon afterwards have picked themselves up by their own bootstraps and recovered their courage and purpose and built what became the Erhard economic miracle. Much helped, I'm sure, by the sudden currency reform, which did away with the black market money and the black marketeers, and introduced the Deutschmark.
What was their attitude towards the occupation forces?
Resigned resentment, I would say. The occupation forces, Well, some of them, I may say, I don't want to generalize, but the Americans perhaps behaved in a rather harsher and perhaps a little more arrogant and less sensitive manner. I had the impression that in the British sector, British soldiers did get on better. I'm sorry this sounds so biased, but it is a genuine impression of mine. They have had, and I noticed it during the war, I noticed it very much in Italy, a knack for somehow getting onto wavelength with people, settling in, becoming friendly, and in a place where you might be new, you would take a stroll and somebody would say good evening and you would offer a cigarette and they'd give you a glass of wine, and by the end of the first evening everybody would have his family. And there was a certain, certainly a contact, certainly some responsivity. And oddly enough, with Americans, I've often found that there was a sort of glass wall and that they would keep themselves very much to themselves and be in their camps, which were, of course, quite lavishly equipped. And they had a lot of social and other facilities, which we lacked, so perhaps that's part of the reason. But again, after the war, I found that though there might be distress and resentment and despondency and resignation, that there seemed to be a little more contact after the non-fraternization regulations were relaxed. It was from Frankfurt after a very bitter winter of 45-46 and the summer of 46 that I was demobbed under release group 46 and entered civilian life, first of all by going back to my family, so to say, in Liverpool, and writing lots of letters to air charter companies, because I felt that the only thing which I knew really, which I had to offer, was language and a little experience of the continent, and eventually got a job with Southampton Air Services, a small charter company. And while in the south, managed to rent half a farmhouse and bring my mother over, who joined me, and then after one affair of the heart which went rather wrong, and a succession of other and vicissitudes, moved to London. While working in the travel business in London, met an old friend with whom I'd been in the 87th Company, who was Austrian extraction and who was also in the travel business, was introduced to his uncle, who ran an engineering company in which I was then employed for a while, and to a family whom he used to know in Vienna, who had a daughter called Alice, who also came here as a refugee in 1938 in her case, who joined the WEFs and also saw some service during the war in her capacity. But that's another story. Where those two stories come together is that we married, that we grew roots, that we had three children and brought up a family, that my mother joined us and lived with us, and saw her grandchildren grow up, and died in her 87th year. So it took a reasonably peaceful and happy end. And for us, there is no end yet. We are enjoying a happy retirement, and we have three children who are all married and eight grandchildren who are keeping my wife very busy indeed. And life begins at 70, so we are looking forward to it.
Thank you very much.